I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. Fareed Zakaria says the global pandemic is nature's revenge for human beings disrupting the natural world, unleashing deadly viruses, including the novel coronavirus that has caused millions of cases of COVID-19 across the globe. He says it's also an opportunity to remake the future for the better. It's not going to be easy. He's the host of the CNN program about international affairs, Fareed Zakaria, GPS, and author of a new book, 10 Lessons for a Post-Pandemic World. Zakaria writes that while America has the capacity to reinvent itself, our belief in our exceptionalism has made us, quote, smug and lazy, and helps explain why our country lags behind other countries that have done so much better containing the devastation of the virus. He joined us by Skype on Radio Times today to talk about how the pandemic is changing our relationship to government, to technology, work, and nature, and why he feels some degree of hope that we can address, if not fix, the challenges we face. Fareed Zakaria, a great pleasure. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you with us. I'm going to begin with you. And this is June 2017. You are talking to your audience on CNN about the possibility of a pandemic. Let's just give it a quick listen.
You hear a lot about the enormous threats coming from terrorism, global warming, and Vladimir Putin. But one of the biggest threats facing the United States isn't big at all. Actually, it's tiny, microscopic, thousands of times smaller than the head of a pin. Deadly pathogens, either man-made or natural, could trigger a global health crisis, and the United States is wholly unprepared to deal with it.
Now, Fareed Zakaria, that was 3.5 years ago. What were you responding to? What did you see that caused you to feel this degree of alarm?
Well, there were two things, really. First, there was the reality that there had been a number of epidemics and what I suppose one might call regional pandemics in Asia, SARS, MERS, H1N1. So there had been these viruses, some of them airborne, and we had watched how they had crippled large parts of the Asian economy. During some of it, I had been running Newsweek International. So I had a very visceral feeling for how disruptive it was because Newsweek's international sales, advertising, everything collapsed during SARS because, although those economies shut down. So I realized that, and then you listen to the scientists who said these things could easily spread. And the second piece was, I have to say, I had been following what Bill Gates had been saying. And Gates gave us a couple of speeches. One was a TED talk and one was a speech somewhere else where he raised the alarm as well. And so I guess it made me think, well, if Bill Gates thinks this, I'm not alone. And I decided to do part of the show on it. And, we laid it out pretty much exactly as it happened. I got one thing wrong, which was I said that I thought it would come from Africa.
Oh, interesting.
Because Ebola had happened, and instead it came from Asia, which, in fact, I should have realized because all these airborne viruses have been coming out of East Asia.
Well, I do want to talk about East Asia and the rest of the world, but I do want to focus on the United States. And as you said in that clip, that the U.S. was unprepared to deal with, and it's clear that turned out to be true. How much do you think, though, is this American exceptionalism that you write about in the book that we think we know better than anybody else, and we don't need their advice, frankly?
So part of what, in fact, the actual trigger for that piece that I did in 2017 was that Donald Trump was trying to really substantially cut back on public health funding and public health preparedness, particularly for pandemics. So that really got my attention. So there's a one layer of it, which is just the Trump administration. There's a second layer of it, which is we have really as a country refused to deal with these kinds of unusual threats. And, as I say, we spent $700 billion protecting ourselves against the Chinese military and the Russian military and Al-Qaeda. And we spend trivial amounts of money on something like this. But at a broad level, the issue that you raise is one that I worry about a lot, which is we don't spend a lot of time looking at how other countries do things. If you think about healthcare in general, forget just pandemics, there are about 15 to 20 advanced industrial countries that offer universal healthcare. They all do much better than we do. We spend three times as much, for example, as Taiwan on healthcare, and we have worse healthcare outcomes on every measure, you know, life expectancy, infant mortality, look at what you will. And we really never ask ourselves, hey, we've got this problem. How does the rest of the world deal with it? Bill Gates once said that throughout his life, whenever he's confronted a problem, he's asked two questions. Who's doing this better and what can I learn from them? We never ask that question. We don't ask it about, you know, gun homicide. We don't ask it about healthcare. And I do think that kind of exceptional mentality, which says, you know, we're the best. We have this country where everything works great, means that you don't spend a lot of time, you know, doing what every business does, which is you benchmark to best practices around the world. And that's really hurt us in this pandemic.
Well, and I wonder whether our president, Donald Trump, exemplifies that. I mean, he famously said he knows more than the generals. Basically, you know, only I can fix it. That was one of the messages that he sent during the 2016 campaign. But he, I mean, it's interesting to run the experiment. If he had said publicly what he said to Bob Woodward privately, whether we would be in better shape. And he talked about the fact that this was a serious threat to our way of life, to our healthcare system, to our economy.
Yeah, with Trump, you don't know where to begin because there were so many mistakes. But you're right. The part of it is this very insular mentality that feels not only that America knows best, but that he personally knows best, part of which is, frankly, just braggadocio. You know, I don't think Trump even believes that. It's just Trump says things that are so wild and bizarre that I often wonder if he really believes it. But I think there is a kind of a larger issue here, which is American government in particular is actually very hard. We don't make it easy. Power in America is divided among three branches of government, among dozens of federal agencies, among thousands of local units, you know, it's center, state, locality, city. And so corralling all that really requires energetic, focused presidential leadership. So it's not even just that he understood the problem, which he seemed to in that conversation with Bob Woodward, but he needed to understand that getting government right in America really requires that you focus in, you get the best people, you marshal them, you get the agencies on track, you work with Congress, you reach out to the governors, and you're doing this every day. This is the people who handled Ebola for the Obama administration were describing to me just how every day you had to remind everybody that they had to all be on the same page, moving in the same direction. It's possible. But I think for somebody like Trump, who really regards, you know, the presidency as a platform from which to issue tweets and to do photo ops, that, you know, it's very hard to run a kind of an effective pandemic response if your model of the presidency is essentially a kind of reality TV show.
Well, and I don't want to spend the hour on talking about President Trump. We have spent probably too many hours on the show talking about the president. But nonetheless, he has been our president for 4 years. But I wonder, so looking ahead and what we know about the incoming Biden administration, if you have some degree of hope that the ship can be righted, at least when it comes to addressing the threats of this pandemic.
I do. I think that a lot of the people he's appointed are very good people. I think that there's still time and we still need much better systems in place to do mass testing, tracing, isolation. You know, it's very important to understand, if you look at Taiwan, yeah, which really gets the gold medal for how they handle this, the key here, which we don't seem to still understand, is not just testing and tracing. It's that you have to isolate the people who are infected or potentially infected. That is the piece we haven't been doing in this country, because the number of people who are getting COVID is actually still relatively small as a share of the population at any given point. But they have to be taken out of circulation. And we don't have a good effective mechanism. I understand we're not a police state. You can't force people to do it. But you can incentivize them. You can watch over them. So what Taiwan would do was they would tell people it was mandatory that they quarantine themselves, and then they would give them a government-issued cell phone, and they would call them three times a day on that.
Wow.
And you couldn't leave the phone at home and go to the grocery store. That was, you know, if the phone was not, if they called and you didn't pick up, that was immediately a violation of the quarantine, and you were fined for it. Now, the result of doing that was that they took the 240,000 people who got COVID or who had potentially gotten COVID because they were exposed to somebody with it. They isolated them for 14 days, but that meant that was 1% of the population. Right. That meant the other 99% could go about their business as usual. Taiwan never had a lockdown. By the way, neither did South Korea, neither did Singapore. It's the same mechanism, you know, so it's just a very smart, it's intelligent action more than it is some kind of great dictatorial action. It doesn't require some great Asian culture. You know, this that we have gotten it into our heads that we can't get this right because we are open, we're democratic. No, it's because we are just not doing government right.
Hmm. Well, it's interesting. You talk about Taiwan and you mentioned Singapore, South Korea, New Zealand. I guess we can throw that in. Hong Kong as well. These are obviously all parts of the Asia, Southeast Asian world who have had experiences with these SARS viruses.
You put it exactly right. I often am asked, is it about Confucian culture? And I always resist those kind of explanations, partly because I grew up in India and I know, you know, Culture is a big, vast bag. You can pull from it whatever you want. You know, you can claim somebody's lazy because of their culture. You can claim somebody's hardworking because of their culture. The reality is, no, it's exactly what you said. They went through SARS and MERS and H1N1. By the way, Taiwan did not handle SARS well, but it learned from its mistakes. And a number of these countries figured out that the key was you have to act early, you have to act aggressively, and you have to act intelligently. And so what I'm most upset about is not that we fumbled it right at the start. Let's remember even, you know, Anthony Fauci and the CDC, they downplayed it initially. Yep. They got sent out the wrong test. It's that 7, 8, 9 months into it, we are still making many of the same mistakes that we were. We still don't have a good mass testing system. We still do not have, you know, what we really need, which are 24 to 48 hour maximum test turnarounds, because otherwise the test is essentially worthless. And we still haven't fixed that system.
That's the very familiar voice of Fareed Zakaria. He is our guest today on Radio Times. We're actually going to take a very short break. We have much more to talk about. He's got a new book, 10 Lessons for a Post-Pandemic World. He's host of CNN's Fareed Zakaria GPS, also writes a foreign affairs column. And we're talking about some of the challenges that this pandemic offers to all of us in terms of remaking the world, making the world a better place, frankly. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can always tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, talking with Fareed Zakaria about his new book, 10 Lessons for a Post-Pandemic World. This is focused more on the United States, but also in the century that we're in, the 21st century. We had the September 11th attacks. We had the 2008-2009 recession, which we really haven't recovered from. And now we've got this pandemic. It seems like that something is seriously wrong. The red lights are blinking, that we've got to fix something.
That's exactly right. I mean, the way I put it is, ever since really the fall of communism, what has happened is, we've had some amazing things happen. The world has come together in many senses. We're all part of one big global economy. We have had many fewer of the barriers to trade, to travel, to even intellectual exchange. The result, however, is that we've created a system that is vast, open, fast-moving, very fast-moving, and as a result, highly unstable. And if you think about, just look at financial crises alone, over the last 20 or 30 years, think about the number of times you've had financial crises. I mean, they started with, let's say, the SNL crisis, and then the Asian crisis, and then the Mexican crisis, and then the Russian default, and then the tech bubble bursting, and then the housing crisis. You know, this is an extraordinary compendium. If you think about 9/11 and the furies that that unleashed, all of this is happening because the world is, as it were, on and kind of fast forward in a very, very intense way. And when you have an open, fast-moving system, it generally tends to be unstable. There's a kind of fancy word for it, that trilemma. I've sort of, my metaphor for it is, it's as if we're driving a very fast car into uncharted terrain. And we've decided, nah, we don't need seatbelts. We don't need airbags. We don't need to buy insurance. The engine blows up once in a while. You patch it up and you just keep moving on. And my fear is that the biggest place we're playing this very risky game is, of course, with nature itself. Right. The unending fast-moving development, for example, that is really why we have these viruses. They come out of Asia because development is very rapid there. And you're crowding out the natural habitat of animals like bats, which have a lot of viruses. And as the bats get closer to human beings, they drop their viruses, as it were, onto intermediate hosts like chickens and pigs and pangolins. And then that's how they hop species to human beings. Or if you look at what's happening in America, the way in which climate change is massively accelerating drought conditions, forest fires, and yet we continue to subsidize, encourage people to live at the edge of forests, at the edge of oceans, which has all kinds of triggering effects. You know, so we seem somewhat blind to this, the reality that we're living dangerously, and then we seem surprised every time there is this backlash.
Well, you write about quality versus quantity of government. Do we have too much government, or do we not have government in the right places? Do we have incompetent government? I'm thinking about what's happening in Washington now. You know, the inability to come up with some kind of rescue package for people who are suffering because of the economic fallout of the pandemic.
Yeah, what's happening right now is absolutely, it's a travesty. And it's very sad because the truth of the matter is the United States handled phase one of this crisis from a public health point of view poorly, but from an economic point of view, quite well. If you remember, Congress passed a $2.2 trillion relief bill. This was basically the largest in the world, even on a per capita basis. I think even only Australia is higher. And so it was really something and that's why we saw, much less economic misery and disruption than one might have imagined. I mean, $2.2 trillion is a lot of money. It's twice the size of the 2009 stimulus, and it was passed in half the time. Now what's happening is we are coming to a point where the public health crisis is likely going to be handled better because of three things. One, the Biden administration, two, therapies, and three, vaccines. So we're coming out of the public health crisis, but we are now screwing up the economic situation by not coming together and passing a relief bill. And the degree to which this is economically stupid and morally abominable, it cannot be exaggerated. You are taking people who have no way of making money because the government has either shut down businesses, or you have a pandemic and nobody's going to, the hotels and theme parks and cruise ships and restaurants and retail. So these people are suffering for no fault of their own. This is not a case where, they manage their companies badly, they manage their personal careers badly, they weren't working hard. None of that is true. This is, literally a kind of act of God. And yet, you cannot get Congress to pass the relief that it needs to, which is going to send the economy into a tailspin. The money, you'd be much smarter spending the money now than even 6 months from now when things will get much worse. So this is part of our deadlocked partisan politics that is just turning this country so dysfunctional. There is a broader issue, as you mentioned, about whether or not our bureaucracies function efficiently. But right now, we're in the grip of this terrible partisan politics that has made it very difficult for people to look at American democracy around the world and say, you know, that's the great system that works that we want to emulate or immigrate to.
But does it also raise questions about how America does capitalism? I'm thinking about how the stock market is just chugging along, seems completely disconnected from the real economy. And in the kind of capitalism we do, there are such stark winners and losers. And, you know, people who are well off in this country are doing perfectly fine, but we've got this incredible economic divide.
Yeah, as you know, I devote a whole chapter to this where I talk about mm-hmm. markets are not enough, and the reason is that we have found a way. Markets are producing a lot of dynamism, a lot of growth, a lot of innovation, and so there are many reasons to celebrate. Except that what you notice is that the markets are able to do this with fewer and fewer people, yeah. with fewer and fewer companies. With more and more computer power. And so it's a very odd situation. And so you take the inequality just at the corporate level. So I write about this in my book, but my book is itself an example of this, by which I mean this. Look at books and book sales. Book sales are actually up over COVID. Book sales are one of the areas that has benefited from the pandemic because not everyone is watching Netflix. A few hardy souls like you who are reading, and so
between watching Netflix, but yes, no, I get it.
Exactly. So you have some people reading more books, so book sales are up. But Amazon was in February 2020 before the pandemic, 30% of the book sales market. Today, it is something close to 70% of the book sales market. So what has happened is a massive winner-take-all effect where the leading company with the strongest digital presence has won. And who is being destroyed? The mom-and-pop independent bookstore, the small regional chain. And of course, that's not just happening in book sales. It's happening in hardware. It's happening at the Home Depot is thriving while the local hardware store that is perhaps not online and such. Is not. You see it with Walmart. So, you know, what you're seeing is this sort of rising inequality at every level. You need a small handful of companies that are digitally savvy, that have big brand names, that have strong credit lines, that have global or regional operations. They thrive. Everybody else struggles. Even restaurants, what I notice is, so in New York City, a third of the restaurants have closed and about another third are likely to close. What is surviving? It's the restaurants that have, you know, chains, or even the chef who has 20 restaurants, the ones that are big companies, the ones that have some kind of consolidated operations. What's not doing well? The mom and pops, the single owner restaurants. So, you know, you have this problem that capitalism has become so efficient, it almost doesn't need a lot of people. It can manage with capital, with computers, with software, with the internet. And so we have to recognize that we need politics, we need government to solve this, to find ways to help really bring everybody along, to create a system that has broader, where the prosperity is shared more. And that means some greater redistribution, it means some better regulation. But all of it is going to have to be done by politics, by government, by people, because the market is actually being very efficient when it allocates, when you go from 30 to 70% for Amazon. That's probably a hyper-efficient system, but it becomes a slightly inhuman one.
United States of Amazon, I think that's what we're becoming, and that's Fareed Zakaria. We're talking about his new book, 10 Lessons for a Post-Pandemic World. A lot of people want to join our conversation. You can do so at Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Let me just toss out one more thing before we get some of our listeners to join the conversation, making the segue from what you were talking about to Denmark, who you say is a country we could take some advice from and perhaps not entirely, but we could sort of remake some of our economy to the benefit of the American people. Can you Can you respond to that concisely? Because we got a lot of people here want to join us.
Sure. Well, I think
it's a big question.
The fascinating thing about Denmark, which I think is so interesting, is that Bernie Sanders often praises it. But then the Prime Minister of Denmark had to come out and say, unlike what Sanders is describing, we are not a socialist economy. We are a market economy. Because what Denmark has done is they've created a very open, very dynamic free market system. But then they use the wealth to redistribute it so that people have equality of opportunity. So you have everything from universal health care to free pre-kindergarten to nutrition programs for poor people to free education from the cradle to PhD programs. So it's a very interesting combination where it's very free market, but it's very redistributionist at the same time. And that's what I think the future. I mean, that is clearly the answer for the future, because what you want is a system that generates a lot of wealth, is dynamic, produces innovation, but then helps everybody to share in that.
Let me get Roger from Philadelphia to join our conversation. And Roger, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Morning.
First of all, great conversation.
Thank
great
you.
Guest. I have to agree with everything we're saying, but I think the one thing that's missing, which could pose as a possible explanation, is these dark money special interest groups that kind of have a vice grip on the government. And a lot of these other countries, I mean, I don't feel like they're going through the same problem that we're going through. You know, it seems absurd in the middle of a pandemic to focus on, rewriting the rules around how campaign finance reform and where we get our money from. And, you know, you talk about the existential threat of climate change. You know, you talk about pandemic preparedness for the future, mass inequality, wealth, health, racial inequality. And if, you know, I work in an emergency room and we're.
Oh, goodness, we lost Roger. And he was working in an emergency room. Thank you for doing that, whatever you're doing, Roger. And thanks for calling into Radio Times. Fareed Zakaria, can we lay it at the feet of special interests that that's the cause of our problems?
Well, I think Roger raises a very important point, which is that, and I think he was getting at this, we're the only major country in the advanced industrial world that raises money for our political campaigns almost entirely through the private sector, and that there are virtually no limits to it. So why is that important? Because what that means is that every politician everywhere is constantly asking himself or herself, how do I raise money? How do I, and what you... Politicians have to, when you're raising that much money from individuals, groups, you're selling something. You know, people are not paying $50,000 to have a breakfast with their congressman because of his winning personality or her winning personality. They're doing it because they're getting something. And what you have to sell is amendments to the tax code, amendments to regulatory issues. So, you know, the U.S. tax code is the longest in the world, as far as I can tell. It's 75,000 pages when you add up all the rules and regulations. Right. By contrast, the German tax code is about 1,000 pages. Why? Because we have all these single-line additions that have been made over the years by congressmen and congresswomen who are selling, you know, they're selling the tax code for money. It just when I put it that way, people realize just how corrupt it is. But that is exactly what it is. So when you think of it in those terms, that is one of the major reasons why American government is so dysfunctional. We have put in so many amendments. There are so many carve outs for so many special interests that it has created one of the most complicated governing systems in the world, where bureaucrats have, you know, they have to kind of navigate through a maze of these regulations. And, you know, the tax code is gamed every day by rich people because it's so complicated. It's a terrible system. I mean, it's one of the reasons why Brussels, for example, the head of the European Union, is able to regulate, for example, technology companies much more cleanly, because, you know, they don't have this problem where the bureaucrats in Brussels may be insular, they may be aloof, they may be whatever people say they are, but they're not sitting every day and selling, you know, trying to raise money from the very companies that they are meant to regulate.
Roger, I appreciate the call. Here's a related question from Lee, who says, it seems going forward only big government can handle or be trusted with future big problems, not the private sector. Fareed Zakaria, do you agree with that? And I'm thinking about this new virus that really was this new vaccine from Pfizer and looks like Moderna's on the horizon, which really was a public-private partnership. But how do you see the role of, I guess, government and the private sector either working together or in opposition?
Look, in general, I think that the issue of big government is really a kind of a 20th century capitalism versus socialism issue. So if you look at the countries that did very well, the best, they all actually have relatively small governments. Taiwan, Singapore, South Korea, even Japan, Vietnam. If you look at the state spending as a percentage of GDP, it's not very high. Now, that's partly because they don't have a big welfare state, but they do have good, strong bureaucratic institutions, good public health, all well-funded. The bureaucrats are given autonomy. They're given respect. They've built trust. There's very low levels of corruption. Those are the core ingredients. That's why I call it in my chapter, the quality of government, not the quantity. But the question you're asking is a very important one, which is when you look at the United States, does it have to be, look, some piece of it does have to be big government because you're dealing with regulating big companies, vast global multinational companies. You're dealing with huge problems. You know, so we are the country that comes up with the vaccine, vaccines because we have the money to subsidize these massive investments in science and technology. So you're right. I mean, if you are going to be the country that spawns and then has to manage the biggest companies in the world, the biggest problems in the world. You know, this is what I often feel people don't understand. You know, the U.S. government is big. People will count them, the budget or the number of people they have. But think about what we are regulating. We're not just regulating for 340 million people in the world. We're often regulating for the whole planet.
And that's Fareed Zakaria. We're going to take another short break, get back to our conversation. He's got a new book, 10 Lessons for a Post-Pandemic World. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also and always tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Fareed Zakaria. He's host of CNN's Fareed Zakaria GPS. He writes a foreign affairs column for The Washington Post, and he's got a new book, 10 Lessons for a Post-Pandemic World. Let me just toss out one or two other things. Looking into your crystal globe, looking into the future, how do you see the future of cities? And I ask that knowing that you say some really interesting things about Paris and its Mayor Hidalgo and how she is kind of reimagining or maybe even reinventing what a modern city can look like and how it can function. Describe that for us.
So historically, you'd have to say that with plagues, and, you know, by the way, remember, we have lots of experience, a lot of history to look back to about plagues. Historically, cities always got emptied out, but then they always got repopulated. People would move out during the plague, and then they'd move back in. The big difference, of course, now is you have this digital life. You have the ability to live a life digitally, to work digitally. Should make clear that is true for only about 30 to 35% of the population in most, even most advanced industrial countries. But again, it accounts for a very large part of GDP. So you have the ability to not have to come back to the city in quite the same way. What is that going to mean? Yeah. My own sense is what you're going to end up with is some hybrid model. People are still going to want to come back to cities for all kinds of reasons, social, competitive. Look, at the end of the day, you go back to a city because people like to hang out with one another. That's they right. like to hang out with one another when they work. They would like to do it when they play. They like to do it, you know, for all kinds of social and entertainment reasons. But cities are going to have to adapt. And what I was struck by in the Paris example you mentioned was this is Mayor Hidalgo in Paris said, why don't we have cities that really have the capacity to provide people with everything they want within a 15-minute walking distance. Hmm. In other words, forget the cities that were planned in the 1950s and 60s, the kind of, madman city, right, where you wake up in a suburban house, you take a train, you go to a workplace, you have two different lives, you come back at 6 o'clock. No, this is much more fluid, much more open. You can move around. And so the idea would be, you have a city where your bank, your restaurant, your everything you want is within 15 minutes. And even perhaps, you have an office center that you could use, some kind of WeWorks-like idea where everybody doesn't need to go to one central office all the time. And she's trying to make it a reality in Paris. The closest, if you want to imagine the future, ironically, it's essentially Manhattan, because Manhattan is a collection of neighborhoods. Everybody thinks of Manhattan as this vast city, but really everyone lives within a 10-block area. And most cities are not like that. Most cities you have, one area that's the business area, one area that's residential, one area where the arts and culture take place. And maybe we need something much more all mixed up, which is, of course, what the cities were in the 18th century.
Well, and it's interesting to think that the future looks a lot like the past. Even work, as you say, I mean, more people, not everybody, obviously, because we have essential workers who have to actually be on the job, but more people are working from home, as we often did in the 19th century and before, where work was done out of the house.
Exactly. Think of a farmer who always lived on his farm, a craftsman who would often be, doing his craft in the basement or the garage, a shopkeeper who often lived above the store. Again, what happened, was we created this factory model almost for all work, where people got up, they went to a big, to a big factory, the office building was in its own way a white collar factory. Mm-hmm. Then they'd come back. And as you say, there are some areas where you still have to have that. But even there, what you're seeing is even healthcare is being transformed by this digital reality that you can, maybe you could imagine doctors saying, Mondays and Fridays, I'm just going to do patient telecalls. And I only need to come into the office and do procedures or whatever it is Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. I think that's the hybrid model. I mean, I think you will never lose the need. You'll always need some central area where we can all get together for all those kinds of reasons. But it doesn't mean you have to be there Monday to Friday, 9 to 5. That's I think what breaks. And a city that can accommodate itself to that more fluid, mixed up hybrid world is going to be the city that will win in the future.
What I worry about is, and I think what this pandemic has shown us, is sort of who is essential and, frankly, what is essential. It's not clear to me that I'm an essential cog in the wheel of our economy. And I think a lot of people are questioning just, how important is it what they or what we do. But are we going to give people who are truly essential to the functioning of our economy? I'm thinking of people at grocery stores, and I mean, there's a long list there. Are we going to pay them what they deserve in the future?
Look, I think that the reality is it's very hard to figure out a way to pay people other than using a market mechanism. So I doubt very much that, the pay of these essential workers who are doing incredibly important work, yeah, is going to go up substantially. But I think what I hope it does is it points to two realities that we should be aware of. One, that the nature of a good society is one in which not everything is determined by how much money you make. Your worth is not determined. Your value to a society, the respect a society accords, should not be determined by that. I remember Obama once telling me in one of the interviews we did, and this was not on air, it was in the sidelines, we were talking about how CEOs are upset with him. And he was pointing out he hadn't really done anything to punish the, bank CEOs in particular. He said, the thing I don't give them is the kind of fawning and respect that they are used to. And it's because I feel like I want to use the power of the presidency to recognize the teachers and the nurses and the intellectuals. And, there are a lot of people in society who don't get the respect they deserve. CEOs get a lot of money and a lot of respect anyway. And I thought there was a very telling a corrective that he was trying to do using his power of the presidency. And the second point I'd make is, you know, forget about respect. There are ways government can help everybody, even financially. And I don't mean giving people handouts, but I mean creating public goods in terms of, you know, good education systems, universal access to good health care, child care for children, good nutrition programs if you're low income, so that people don't feel that, you know, having as little money is as big a sting as it feels. You know, there's a line that I always think about in the movie Jerry Maguire, where the single mom is saying, you know, she's in a plane and she's peering into first class, and she's just had a very rough life. And her kid asks her, what are you looking at, mom? And she says, first class, honey. It used to be a better meal, but now it's a better life. And I think there's something there where we have to make it so that money is not the sole determinant of what makes for a better life.
Let me just quote John Kenneth Galbraith, who you quote in your book. And I have to say, I scribbled under this quote about the U.S. being defined by, quote, private opulence and public squalor. Now, that was, what, several generations ago, but it seems like it really does apply to today. Fareed, we got a lot of people. Let me get CJ to join our conversation. CJ calling us from, looks like, Northern Virginia. Hi, CJ. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi there. Great conversation.
Thank you.
I work with a number of NGOs, speak to a number of consultants, and the scuttlebutt that's been going back and forth between us with the whispering from various government.
You know, CJ, I hate to do this to you only because I know you've been hanging on, but we do have a terrible phone line, and maybe you can call us back and we can try to establish a better phone line. Let me get another caller to join our conversation, and this is Cipriano calling us from Collegeville. And Cipriano, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you, Marty.
Sure.
So I just wanted to talk about a little bit your talk about the having funding for your campaigns and everything come from the public sector instead of the private, coming from the Dominican Republic, where that is the case, I can tell you that that does lead to definite drawbacks. You look at Leonel Fernandez, he used that to his benefit, pretty much to bribe legally the entire system to keep him in power. Now, we could see where that could lead us today with our current president, if that was the case, that would lead to another messy situation where he has purse that is granted to him by rules that he can then, you know, jiggle and move to his favor. I think we have a good system at the moment where we can, you know, monitor some of the funds. There is black money. So maybe there needs to be a compromise, but I don't think it's a full get rid of our private funding system.
I hear you. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. A lot of people, Fareed, are concerned about money in politics, and I think, well, they should be. Anything you want to add to what Cipriano was saying?
No, he raises a good point, and that's one of the reasons why I'm not sure exactly what the best reform is. I myself think that you know, we're never going to get public funding, and it does have the problems he's describing. But I think, you know, if we could get more transparency, more limits, I think it would make for a better system. If you look at, you know, I mean, the entire British national election costs as much as a Midwestern Senate race in the United States, the entire British election. And that's because they have very strict limits on how much you can spend. You can't, you know, you can't buy radio or TV ads. You can't buy radio ads past a certain point. Last week, I think, or 10 days, you can't even do polling. So there are all kinds of mechanisms designed to just take the influence of money, you know, out. Because I think the fundamental mistake that we've made, and it's a Supreme Court decision from the 1970s, is to believe that money is equal to free speech.
Right.
I think that mistakes the reality. Look, we all should have the ability to speak our views and to do that in 100 different ways. But to say that somebody who writes an op-ed and somebody who gives $5 million to a political action committee is exercising the same right of free speech is ludicrous. One person is buying enormous influence with the politician to whom he or she gives that $5 million.
We have just a couple of minutes. I have a couple of questions for you. One of them, looking at the foreign policy team that President-elect Joe Biden has assembled so far. What do you make of the team, and what is the message, I guess, coming out of this administration, which will be taking over in about a month or so?
I think the message overwhelmingly is competence matters. He is trying to find people who have done these jobs or done junior versions of these jobs or understand how government works, who have distinguished records in it. He's trying to make sure that he gets people who are working together as a team rather than undermining each other. These are all people who mostly who have worked together in some way or the other. There's always a danger of a little bit of groupthink in that situation. Sure. You know, you want to have some outside perspectives and some fresh perspectives. But by and large, I think more than anything else, he's trying to say we are going to entrust government to people who understand how it works, who want to make it work, and who understand how to work as a team.
You have some advice for a post-Trump world. One is that presidents should release their taxes, their finances. There should be real blind trust, not the ones that we have now. And interestingly, you say that inauguration should come sooner. It's about, what, 2.5 months between Election Day and when a new president is essentially becomes the president. What, it's too long, too much mischief for the current president?
Yeah, it's actually, if you think about it.
Oops. I think we lost.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, okay, there we go. You're back. Okay.
I accidentally muted my mic.
Okay.
It turns out if you press
nothing
the
like
space
live
bar,
radio to give me like agita here, but go ahead, Fareed Zakaria.
If you press the space bar, it mutes your.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's the longest in the world. I mean, the British election, the prime minister, it's 24 hours. So, you know, you're out of Downing Street and the new prime minister is in the next morning. In France, it's 10 days. I think there's one country in the world that has it. And yes, it creates all kinds of perverse incentives where it makes it possible for the lame duck president, who's only lame duck in tradition, he or she has all the powers of the presidency to do all kinds of crazy stuff. In a sense, Trump is giving us is playing out for us the worst case scenario, how you can use the office to abuse it in various ways. He's making last minute appointments to all kinds of things. He pardoned people, you know. In a way, what Trump has done is he's given us a good primer in how much of American democracy has depended on the goodwill of people involved, the honor of people involved, people following norms rather than having rules that are specifically laid out that they have to follow. And this period of 2.5 months, which was designed because it was a big country and it would take people that long to move around, this period is just much too long, much too treacherous. Unfortunately, it would require a constitutional amendment, but there's no doubt in my mind a much smarter system would be. I mean, give people a week. When you have a company like Microsoft have a new CEO, the guy comes in one, you know, in a day or two. Surely we could do that with the U.S. government.
Well, Fareed Zakaria, so much more to talk about. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
It really was my pleasure.
Yeah, you're very welcome. And again, he's got a new book, 10 Lessons for a Post-Pandemic World. He's also host of CNN's Fareed Zakaria GPS, and he writes a foreign affairs column for The Washington Post. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.